Hello, hello, hello. My name is Robert. I am the recovery guy, and you have entered into The Fix.
There we go. Well, I love this room. It's almost as big as my ego. Not quite. And gosh, Ian, I don't get introduced that nicely at home, so it's good to be here. My name is Robert, and I am a recovered alcoholic.
Hey, Robert.
By the grace of God, who is crazy about me and proves that he has no taste. Amazing sponsorship. I've never known a sober moment without a sponsor. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 Steps, and Service to Others. I haven't found it necessary to drink or take any mind-altering chemicals since April 25th of 1986. And for that, I owe AA my life. I don't know what I'm going to say. There's always three talks that I give. One that I plan 4 or 5 days in advance, one I give, and then one I say I should have given as I drive home. And it's always interesting. I really appreciate Dave. Thanks for being here. One of the reasons I go to meetings still after almost 38 years of personal recovery is you always hear something in a meeting that can add to your recovery or help you crystallize something that you're going to tell a newcomer and help them further understand. And Dave was talking about understanding the insanity and the unmanageability of his life, and I really learned a lot. And so thank you for that contribution to my sobriety, and unbeknownst to you, you're contributing to the sobriety of men that I work with. It's good to see you all here tonight. Let me do a show of hands. Don't raise your hand if you're in your last 30 days of recovery and you don't know it. But if you're under a year of sobriety, raise your hand. Under a year. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, I remember taking my one-year chip, and it was at the Attitude Adjustment Meeting in Las Vegas. I got sober in Las Vegas, Nevada. I tell people it's kind of like learning how to swim in a shark tank. It's, you know, for those of you who are old enough to remember, there was a show called Let's Make a Deal with Monty Hall. And at the end of the show, Monty would always try to entice you with door number 3. You know, you'd win the prize, door number 1 or door number 2. And then if you really like that, the problem with door number 3 is you didn't know what was back there. But you could gamble everything on door number 3. I'm here to tell you there is no door number 3. Either your alcoholism is untreated or it's treated. And that's entirely up to you. Because rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. So as you raise your hand tonight, and if you've been sober for a while, I know why you're sober. If you're happy, joyous, and free, I know why you're happy, joyous, and free. And if you're a chronic relapser, I know why that is too. Not because I'm smarter than the next person, although my ego would argue that point. It's because I understand the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I understand despair. And I understand what it's like to look in the mirror and think you're going to die and there's nothing you can do about it. You burnt your life to the ground so many times. No one wants to talk to you. No one will hire you. My second wife had already kicked me out. I'd already walked out on my first wife, and I literally moved my children out of the way so I could go drink. If my mom and dad knew that I was over at their house, they would have stood guard and not allowed me to come in. Brothers and sisters stopped answering the phone if they knew it was me. There was no place left for me to go. And here I was, standing in front of the mirror, and You know the voices that you hear of disappointment, of people, and it's like, it's appropriate here, I would always call it the tabernacle choir. And they would always be saying things like, Bobby, 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 what are you doing? Nobody understood. Nobody understood what I knew. And what I knew was I didn't fit. No matter how much you loved me, how much you cared for me, how much you gave me, there was a component in me that just couldn't receive it. And here I was. The only thing that comforted me was alcohol. The only thing that told me that everything was going to be okay was alcohol, and subsequently drugs and all the other things that cling to us as we make our way to recovery. And here I was standing in front of the mirror, and this was on February 9th of 1986, because I would relapse after 71 days, so I know why people relapse. I know why I relapsed, and looks pretty in line with the book, why other people relapse as well. It's not rocket science. I wish it was, because then I could be really smart when I figured it out, and I wouldn't have to feel as dumb when I failed, right? Because it's rocket science. You know, who gets that? And you know, I know you hear a lot of times that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is a simple program for complicated people. It's not true. It's a simple program for simple people who love to complicate things. That's the truth. Because you ask me what time it is, and I just might tell you how to build a watch. And that's really true. You can ask my wife. She'll tell you. She says, can't you just narrow this thing down? Can you just make it simpler? It's like, no, we have to have detail. We have to have color, right? And the only part of The Wizard of Oz I never liked was the opening part when it was black and white. The rest of it was really pretty good. So here I am standing in front of the mirror, and I think I'm going to die, and there's nothing I can do. And I'd lost my job the previous night, so I had no insurance, I had no money, and I didn't have employment. So I called these treatment centers, and that's all they, back in Las Vegas, back in the 80s, that's what they wanted to know. Do you have a job? Do you have insurance? Do you have money? No, no, no. Click. Call the next one. Do you have a job? Do you have insurance? Do you have money? Click. No. Go on to the next one. Finally, I contacted the Nevada Treatment Center, and they told me that if I could get there within 1 hour with $50, kind of impossible, if I could get anywhere with an hour with $50, especially in Las Vegas, because my first 12-step meeting was Gamblers Anonymous. Because Father Martin will tell you the number one rule of every alcoholic is to protect the supply. So you could touch anything about me, but don't touch my alcohol. And so Gamblers, I thought, well, I'll go to Gamblers Anonymous first. And of course, Gamblers Anonymous doesn't work. I want you to know that in advance. Probably had a lot to do with me not working the program. I made that connection all by myself. And so I finally called, and I called my dad. My dad was sober 7 years at the time. And he was rather disappointed in me, obviously, because he was trying to change and make his life better, and I failed. But I called my dad, and I said, Dad, I found a treatment center. And it was really ironic, coincidental, and here's where God was even working in my life before I even had a relationship with a higher power. You know, denial is the main ingredient of alcoholism. You know, you can have the most highly trained professionals tell you. You know, I remember being diagnosed in 82 or 83 at Nevada Psychiatric Center, and they said I have obsessive compulsive disorder with alcoholism, and the prognosis was I would never get better. So I spent the next 3 years proving that they were right. And so here I was faced with an opportunity to go into treatment. And that was my first introduction into recovery at the Nevada Treatment Center in Las Vegas, Nevada. But you know, that wouldn't be enough for me, because there's this thing in AA about honesty. You know, the steps mandate that you're honest. And I tried, but I was convinced that if you knew who I was and you knew the type of person I was and the things that a person like me did, that I would be the first person in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous that you would ask not to come back. I knew it. So I would tell you things on the fringe, even though you were telling me things that I thought, wow, you did that. I did that more than you did. Or you would tell me a story and say, you one sick SOB. I mean, what are you doing here? And I couldn't find my way either way because I knew what my truth was. And I couldn't share that truth with you. And so I treated the program of Alcoholics Anonymous like a buffet. You know, you go into a buffet, you know what you want, you know what you don't want. I know Chuck-O-Rama has incredible chicken. So if I go to Chuck-O-Rama, you know it's for the fried chicken. But I'm going to skip the asparagus and the other things. That's how I would treat Alcoholics Anonymous. I would go in and say, I want some of this, I want some of that. Step one, I can do that marginally. Step four and five, forget about it. You know, I might have hurt you, so I could maybe do steps 8 and 9. And I can take a partial inventory, so maybe step 10, this God thing, I can marginalize that. And I'll help you when it's convenient to me in step 12. And so that's the way I was. And if you're that way, stop being that way. Because it's been my experience that when we're that way, we're just buying time between drinks. It's not if we're going to relapse. It's when. And as it says in the big book, that if you're not sure that you're an alcoholic, I'm not going to convince you. Because either way, trust me when I tell you, I'm going to sleep like a baby. I'm going to sleep really good, whether you stay sober or not. I would prefer you stay sober. But I recommend that you go get a bellyful of your condition. Because that's what it recommends in the big book. And tonight, as I share with you, my story is my story. But I'll stay within the first 164 pages because I'll suggest an argument that you can't win. And I have so much evidence of this thing working that it's undeniable. So as I'm a child, you know, when we kind of figure out where we came from, what happened, where did this whole thing start? I mean, I could tell you I started drinking when I was 14, but what led to that drink? What kind of emotional despair and depravity was a part of my life that not made me drink the first time, but the second time? That was the kicker. Because the first time I drank primarily because I could get away with it. Right, me and my friends sitting around a tree. It was the summer. We had nothing better to do. Our parents were passed out at the time. So, you know, Johnny get that, Donnie get that, I get that. And we sit under the tree and we get drunk. But something magical happened. And maybe you can relate. Because when you come from nothing and you are nothing and you're convinced you're always going to be a nothing and you drink and it makes you what I call an almost, that's incredible. Being an almost, because I knew it wasn't going to be anything at any time. So being an almost was the top of the world for a person like me. But I remember being 5 and 6 years old and crying myself to sleep. I was a chronic bedwetter until I was 11 because I had so much anxiety. So alcohol was a relief to me. And my alcoholism progressed so quickly that while from 14 to 18 years old, you know, you have school and things and other commitments, so you can't drink as much as you want to drink, although if you could, you would, or I would anyway. But by the time I was 18 years old, as a periodic drinker, alcohol was already taking me. In Japan, there's a phrase that says, first the man takes a drink, then the drink takes a drink, then the drink takes the man. The drink was taking a drink by the time I was 18 years old. Matter of fact, tell you how, and this goes back to what Dave was sharing about the insanity. When I was 18 years old on January 3rd of 1972, I know this hair is crazy. I don't look that old, but I am. I walked into the registrar's office and I said, I'm dropping out of high school. And they said, you can't do that. And I held up my license that I can do whatever I want. I'm 18. I'll show you. I'll kill me. And that opened the door and freed up my time that I wanted. See, I thought I was making an independent decision, but it was just the beginning of things that I would begin dropping out of. You know, later on in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would find out that they were called geographics. Pretty common with you and me. But I dropped out of high school and I began my drinking career. You know, in the beginning, you don't think it's as bad, even though people are telling you. I mean, what person, I could have not shown up and graduated in May. But I was so tired of being under the control of a person that I didn't trust that I took whatever control I had. See, lack of power, that was my dilemma. And I didn't feel I had power. So I had to assert myself by making a public example and a statement that I can control my life. I didn't even know what that meant because my alcoholism would continue to get worse. So I thought it'd be a great idea. I'll drop out of high school to join the Air Force. That'll fix me. So I went into the Air Force, I think it was in April, and I was out of the Air Force by June. I never got out of basic training because all I wanted to do was drink. You know, it says in chapter 3, the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. And at 18 years old, I was already obsessed. I had to drink. There was a mechanism in my mind that said, you're not going to be okay until you drink. Once I drank, the alcoholism, the phenomenon of craving would take over. I didn't know it was a phenomenon of craving until I came into AA and know and understand what I recovered from. And just so you know, I'm recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. So before any of you say, well, this guy said he's cured, blah, 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 that's not what I said, don't get it twisted. It says, to show other alcoholics is precisely why we wrote this book. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. So that's why I say I'm a recovered alcoholic, because I've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Doesn't mean I don't have problems, but they're not hopeless anymore. There's always hope because I have a power greater than me that does for me what I can't do for myself. So here I am joining the Air Force, and it didn't take my flight leader long to figure out I just didn't fit in. There was something about me that distracted me, and they sent me to this wonderful place called motivation. Now, that's a nice word, but it's not necessarily a great place. It's a place where you have to ask permission to speak before you can speak. And so I remember one day, my sergeant comes to me, and he says, what are you doing here? I said, well, pretty freaking obvious what I'm doing here. I got in trouble. And he said, no, what are you doing? What are you doing here? Because if you went back to your flight, you would graduate with top honors. And that would be a somebody. But I knew at best I would only be an almost. And I was convinced when I was 18 years old that the most I would ever be, could you imagine you have your whole life ahead of you and the best you're going to be is an almost. And that's when you drink. I was out of control when I was sober because I had an obsession. Father Martin has a wonderful phrase. He says it's a natural human response to seek relief from that which is uncomfortable. So when you have a headache, you take an aspirin. When it's cold, you put on a jacket. When you're tired, you take a nap. All those things that we do. But what do you do when that which you're uncomfortable with is you? Mm-hmm. From the inside out. We're afraid to let anyone see us because if they saw the scared child in me, they wouldn't have known what to do. So we put on these masks, we play these charades, we become very chameleon to be whatever we need to be in that circumstance to extract from the person what we need to take from them. And every relationship I ever had was one-sided. In the Air Force, in high school, it was no different. So I thought, so they got me out of the Air Force, and they were really nice to me. They gave me a general discharge under honorable conditions. That was really nice. What they really did for me was really great. They gave me an open-ended prescription of 20 milligram Valium. That's what you give. And I wasn't a drug addict, although drugs are a big part of my story, but I did drugs alcoholically. And I used to hang out with these guys who cooked meth in Vegas, and they were afraid of me. They said, "You need to slow down, buddy." You know, I said, "Where's the pipe? Where's the line? What can I do? You know, because I need to go and drink." Because I figured out early on, and I'm getting ahead of myself, and that's okay. It helps my mind stay in control. I remember remorse. Remember remorse? Where you wake up every day and you realize how many disappointed people you left in your wake the day before. I figured out, this is pretty good. This is math and science, kind of like combined. So I figured if I did enough math, I could cut my remorse down to like 3 days a week. That was worth it, you know? Because if you don't have to wake up every day feeling like a piece of crap, it doesn't matter what you have to do if you can just wake up every third day and feel like a piece of crap. You don't feel more like a piece of crap. It just condenses it, consolidates it. And that's where my addiction took me. And so here I am traveling through, and I get out of the Air Force in June of 1972, and I think, I know what I'll do. I'll go back up to Oregon, and I'll date this girl. That'll fix me. So I go back up to Oregon, and I marry her just to reveal how bad of a husband I could really be. And things just cycle, and they cycle, and they cycle. And there comes a time, it says in the doctor's opinion, we are no longer able to differentiate the true from the false. Our life seems to be the only normal one. We're discontent, we're miserable, we're all the things that it says. And unless we can have the same ease and comfort, it says, that comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks we see others taking with impunity. And it says it's repeated over and over and over again. And I'll add some overs, because it's just over and over and over and over and over again. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope for that person. And that's where I was when I was 32 years old. I'm not a war story person, so we're going to set that aside. But when I came into recovery, I was introduced to a group of men and women who seemed to have figured this thing out. And I remember going to the Turning Point. It's closed down now, the Turning Point in Las Vegas. And thank goodness it was open 24 hours a day, because I couldn't sleep and I was unemployable. And I was just a mess. So I was either the door greeter, or I was in a meeting, I was sitting at the coffee bar, I was doing something just to get out of me long enough so I didn't go, you know, commit suicide or drinking. And I didn't want to kill myself, I just didn't know how to live. You'll hear that a lot. It's not that we want to die. We haven't known how to live for a long time. And alcohol sustained us, you know. I would tell people that alcohol kept me from blowing my brains out, because I didn't understand why it hurt so much being me. And that takes me back to 5 and 6 years old. My dad used to say, all the time, he'd say, "God bless you and God is your life." So an understanding of a God-centeredness was in my home, but I couldn't reconcile why it hurt so much being me. If God is real, if God is this God bless you person and God is your life, how come it hurt so much being me? And I remember getting high and going over to parties and having to get a little drunk, a little high before I got there so you wouldn't see how much I drank and used, you know. And then when I came into AA, I saw a group of people who were happy and sober at the same time. And that was pretty remarkable, because you understood me in a way that other people didn't understand me. You knew, and I knew... You knew what I was going through, because every time I heard you share, you sounded just like the inside of me. And I wanted so much to tell you how afraid I was. I would sit in meetings and I would be so afraid, because I would be the only person in the room who wasn't going to get well. And I saw you get well, and I was just like you, but that's how I grew up. I saw normal people doing normal things, and I never quite fit in. And it was even more disturbing in AA because, again, you sounded just like me. And at the time, you know, they say 90 meetings in 90 days. I think I did 90 meetings in 1 week, you know. When you have 24-hour clubs and there's 8 meetings a day and you're unemployable, it's easy to knock out 90 meetings. But it's not the quantity. It's the quality, you know. And I would listen. And it finally came to a place where I either had to concede to my innermost self, as it says on page 30, that I was alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. Because I could tell Tim all day long, hey, my name is Robin, I'm alcoholic. But that's just what it says on the wall. You know, I would pay lip service because I was smart enough to know that I just needed to sound like you. I wasn't ready to be honest like you. But if I could sound like you, you know, we thought we could find an easier, softer way, but I was going to try, right? And it actually says, but we could not. That's why it says, with all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. I'll beg you tonight. And again, the key is, I don't beg you for me, because I've carried the message. I'm fine. I've been sober 13,846 days, and I'll probably hit 13,847. Thank you for that. The check is in the mail, I promise you. The timing was fantastic. You know, it's not about sounding. You know, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. So here I was. I was working for a Las Vegas entertainer at the time, and I thought, well, I can go back and do that, and I can do this, and I can do that, and I can live, you know, you have 1 foot in yesterday and 1 foot in tomorrow, and you urinate all over today, right? And that's where I was trying to live. I was trying to live with only being honest enough with you, but not losing contact with the world that I knew I would have to attach with eventually, or again. And I went back, and it didn't take long. I think I was drunk the second night that I was there, because that was just that lifestyle. And I remember going back to my dad, and he said, you can't stay here because your mom and I aren't going to want you die. Mm-hmm. My dad said that. And that was on April 19th of 1986. And he took me to this lovely motel called the Rhett Butler Motel. I think they've torn it down for good reason. It was in 15th and Fremont. If you're familiar with Las Vegas at all, it's called Heroin Heights. And Caddy Corner was perfect bar because it was Caddy Corner from the Sundowner Saloon, which was perfect for a guy like me. And he dropped me off, and my dad was bigger than me. And I watched him walk away, and I could see his shoulders shrugging. And I knew he was crying. But I couldn't go to him because I couldn't be honest. So I sat in the bar for 2 or 3 nights, just drinking whatever scotch I could afford and drinking beer, because that's the only purpose of beer, is to chase down scotch. And I remember on April 24th, I ordered a scotch on the rocks, and there was a shift change. And the bartender who served me my drink was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And boy, was I embarrassed. And I almost didn't take the drink, but the alcoholic said, take the freaking drink, right? And so he looked at me and said, if you're lucky, there will be tomorrow. And I went back to my hotel room. And I had been in AA 71 days. And in that relatively short period of time, the voices of disappointment were replaced with the voices of encouragement. Keep coming back, one day at a time. Take it easy, keep it simple. All the things you told me, we'll love you until you can learn. Those voices replaced the voices I heard. And I tried to get drunk, tried to recapture that feeling of being an almost. And I couldn't do it because AA was now living in my head. And that morning of April 25th, 1986, I walked back to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I surrendered. And God's timing is unbelievable. At a meeting that my sponsor never went to, he was there an hour after the meeting was over. And I walked in the back door because I wanted to avoid all the people who would say, "Where have you been?" And he was there waiting for me. And I don't know who was more surprised, Max or me. Because he wasn't expecting me, and I certainly wasn't expecting him. I'd have gone in the front door before I had to see Max, because I was accountable to him. And he asked me, not where I was, because he knew. He said, "Are you ready?" And I said, "Max, I can't tell you how much I need this." And he said, "Look, I don't care if you need it. There's a whole city that needs this. But if you want what we have, and you're willing to go into any lengths to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. And if you want it, I'll help you. If you need it, we'll just be friends. No harm, no foul." And so I said, "Max, I can't tell you how much I need this." And we got on our knees and we did the third step prayer. And I've been clean and sober ever since. Everything I owe and everything I have and everything I am, when I tell you I owe it to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm not kidding. And Max would subsequently move. And I knew I needed a sponsor because I never knew a sober moment, whether I was adhering to the principles or not, which are the steps. I know there's a big adage out there, drop the rock or whatever that book is, and there's a set of principles. Don't get it twisted. When Bill says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles. What are the principles? The principles are the steps. If you read the big book and you read the 12 and 12, so mystery solved there. Some people, I was in a newcomer meeting the other night, chase this rabbit for you, and this guy was wondering how he could be a better dad. And he was a chronic relapser. I said, "Why don't you be a recovered alcoholic? And you can be a better dad. Because if you work it from the outside in, you'll relapse. If you work it from the inside out, you get to be sober for a minute." So Max and I prayed, and then he moved, and then I would find a sponsor. God would direct me to a person. I went to Jack, and after praying, I went up to him, and I said, he was manager of the Alano Club and subsequent intergroup manager, and I said, "God told me that you were going to be my sponsor." And he said, "Well, who am I to argue with God?" And I agreed with him, although I was probably God at that point. And he was my sponsor for 32 years. And he died in January of 2019. And in that window of time, he taught me things about the big book that are irreplaceable and are part of my daily life. And the steps are the magic. The first 164 pages, if you're new or relatively new to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the hardest thing we do is understand our condition. Because we suffer from a disease, and it is a disease, and we're not bad people trying to get better, we're sick people trying to get well. Understand that. Now, we did some pretty bad things along the way, but that doesn't mean we're bad. We're actually pretty wonderful people. I mean, I knew I liked you, and I didn't even have to have three or four drinks, right? Well, a couple of you I don't care for. No, I'm just kidding. Well, there's actually just two. So everything I know is in the 12 steps, and that's what these men walked this man through. And I believe, you know, if you're a female, you probably should get a female sponsor. If you're a man, get a man. Matter of fact, the biggest commodity in Alcoholics Anonymous is sober women. You know, men, we're a dime a dozen, you know, but sober women. So if you're a sober woman, God bless you, and I hope you affect it, as many women as possible, because women are held hostage in ways that men don't even understand. We don't even get it. That's one of the reasons we shouldn't sponsor you. So as I'm going through, I had to understand what untreated alcoholism looks like. I knew when I took my inventory, when I conceded to my innermost self that I was alcoholic, when I did my inventory in step one, and I admitted I was powerless over alcohol, because it says on page 30, the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. It's an obsession. It's not just a regular obsession. It's a great obsession. And great is superior to good, right? Good is the enemy of great. And so it's the great obsession. So my brain tells me I have to drink, and the phenomenon of craving says we got it from here, right? So I have to understand that, and the unmanageability that occurs as a result of my drinking. Understand step one. It doesn't say I'm powerless over alcohol and my life has become unmanageable. There's no and there. It's actually a hyphen. As a direct result of my drinking, my life has become unmanageable because I didn't know a sober moment in most every important dealing of my life. And once I recognize that and understand that, then I'm ready, because only an insane person drinks in spite of their life problems. And at that moment, I come to believe that a power greater than me can restore me to sanity. Because if I don't think I'm insane by my actions in step one, why in the heck would I be willing to turn my will and my life over to the care of God that I can't see? Why would I do that? It wouldn't make sense. And I was telling my friend on the way down, when we come into recovery, it's an emotional decision. Nobody got here by rationale, regardless of what you think, maybe one or two. But for the most part, we get here, it's based on emotion. We're tired of burning our life to the ground. The wife says, if you don't stop drinking, I'm going to change the locks. The boss says, if you do it again, I'm going to fire you. The court says, if you don't go into this treatment program, I'm going to give you 3 years or 5 years. CPS says, if you don't do this, I'm going to take your kid. You know, there's this element that forces us into treatment. But somewhere along the line, the act of surrender needs to become a state of surrender. And the state of surrender occurs by understanding how the steps work. And they work this way for a reason. So when I understand how unmanageable my life is in step one, that automatically leads me to step two. And step two, if I'm going to be restored to sanity and my life isn't going to be run by an idiot, then I need to turn that will and that life over to someone or something that can do for me what I can't do for myself. And in the beginning, if you struggle with the higher power like many of us do, what's wrong with the group? Because obviously we're doing something you can't. And eventually that has to transfer, in my opinion. But once I turn that will and that life over to the care of God, see, it says a moral and fearless. People say they're afraid of step four. Well, read step four. Why are you afraid when it says fearless? If I'm in fear, that means I need to go back and revisit step three. Because why should I be afraid of something that I'm not in charge of? Right? And step five is almost a relief, because when I get to step five, like, we're only as sick as our secrets. So when I tell God, who already knows, myself, I've known for a long time, and my sponsor probably has a pretty good idea because he's gone through the same thing. So it's not like it's any mystery. Oh, crap, you did that. No, I pretty much expect, oh, that's all you did? Let me tell you what I did, you know. And then step six is really, I think we make more out of step six than we need to. God is not removing my defects of character. I'm just entirely ready that he does it. Don't complicate something that is designed to be simple for simple people. So I was entirely ready, because I'm tired. By this point, I'm so tired. I can't live with alcohol and I can't live without it. Somewhere along the line, I need to be refreshed. And that's what the steps do. So when I get to step six and I'm entirely ready, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. And then in step seven, I humbly ask him to remove these shortcomings. Do you know what a shortcoming is? It's a defect of character. Bill was smart enough that he knew in grammar you don't use the same word to identify the same thing, otherwise it's redundant. So when you look at the steps and you see the exact nature of our wrongs, defects of character, and shortcomings, they're all the same thing. They're all the exact same thing. And one of my defects of character, one of my shortcomings is I can't admit to you when I'm wrong. I always want it to be your fault, because if it's your fault, it's not mine. And if you haven't apologized to me, why should I apologize to you? So that's why I need to make the list of all persons I had harmed, not all persons who had harmed me. It's been about me for a little bit too long. Matter of fact, that's why I'm in this mess in the first place. Everything was about me. And I make that list. And don't be afraid of step eight, because all you're doing is making a list. You haven't done anything with it yet. You know, and Joe and Charlie say something really great. Start with the people that you know you want to make amends to, and work down to people you would never make amends to. And when you get to the people that are maybe, you'll get to the people who are never. Because there's a certain cleansing that occurs when I come to you and I say, I'm so sorry. I can't tell you how badly I feel for how I hurt you. And you leave it alone. And the magical thing about step nine is I don't need you to accept my amends for it to be complete. Any more than I need you to get sober for my 12 step to be complete. I want you to get sober and I want you to forgive me. I don't want you to think I'm an a-hole for the rest of my life or the rest of yours. So that's kind of a neat thing, but it's not necessary. I asked you to forgive me for the wrongs that I've committed. And then I get to do this thing called step 10. You know what? If I go to one more meeting and I hear somebody say they did another step four, I'm going to lose my mind. You do another step four, and I'll go up to them and I'll say, I'm sorry, did you relapse? Oh, no, I didn't relapse. Well, why are you doing step four again? Because we don't understand step 10. If you read step 10, I think it's page 83 of the big book, it'll tell you all about steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. So when I do step 10 every day, during the day, not at night, because at night it's too late. Nobody wants an inventory they don't do anything with, so I take my inventory during the day, and when I'm wrong, I promptly admit it, and I'm automatically doing steps 4 through 9. And that reminds me of my humanity. Boy, it doesn't take long for me to understand my humanity before I realize that I need to improve my conscious contact with God. Because that's my problem. My problem between my wife and me is there's too much me. There needs to be more God. That's what makes me a better person. That's what makes me a better husband. What makes me a better friend. That's what makes me a better sponsor is God doing for me. So when I enter into step 11, sought through prayer and meditation, not to connect, to improve my conscious contact with God as we understood God, praying only for the knowledge of Him. Only, it's an inclusive word, means there's nothing else. I know that much about grammar. And I say that in the nicest way. Understand what the steps say and apply them accordingly. Not according to what's comfortable to me, but what's comfortable for the first 100. Because I can't defend me, but I can defend the first 164 pages, because that's how I've been trained. And I love it, because then I get to recognize my spiritual awakening. And man, when you go from a person who thinks they're going to die, or you be the person who moves their children out of the way so you can go get drunk, to a person who's had a spiritual awakening, I want you to experience that, because it's crazy. I wake up every morning. The other morning, I woke up and I rolled over and I see these beautiful plants that Laura has by the window, and I took a picture because I wanted to look at it, because I wanted to remember the first thing I saw. Filtered light coming through our blinds and three beautiful plants that are hanging there. That's how I wake up. And I say, God, what can I do for the alcoholic who's still sick? Because then I try to carry this message. Sometimes you don't let me carry the message, but that doesn't mean I don't try. And then what do? I practice these principles or the steps in all my affairs. Not the ones that I think are good at Chuck-O-Rama, because I want to eat this and I want to eat that, But in all my affairs, what does all mean? It means all. Especially the ones I'm uncomfortable with. So I'm not going to do that. I should do that first. And when I do that on a regular basis, my value to you, and that's all I ever wanted. I just wanted people to see me as a person of value. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous does that for me in ways that I can't even express. You know, I'm 70 years old, and I'm going to die. This is what's really cool. I'm going to likely die of old age. That's not too shabby. For a guy who should have died in a head-on collision on his way to killing what I call the Jones family of five. You know, I go into prisons and institutions, and I'm not that guy sitting in the cell doing 25 years after waking up in a holding tank wondering what happened, how he got there, and he finds out he killed the family. I could have been that guy. But for whatever reason, God has chosen you to be in this room tonight. What are you going to do? And God is important. Good news and bad news. You cannot work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous unless you have a power that's greater than yourself. Period. The good news is that power can be anything you want. Providing, don't tell me it's a doorknob or a coffee cup. That's a bunch of crap. Because that higher power needs to do something for you what you could not do for yourself. And last time I checked, the doorknob doesn't work unless I, the ego, turns and opens the door. And a coffee cup has no purpose until I put coffee in and I pick it up. It's all about me. It's only when me becomes we that we make a difference. And I'm going to close with this. Maybe my favorite page of the big book is page 17. There's a solution. And it's my favorite page because I think it's the most melodic page. But it marries the two elements of Alcoholics Anonymous, which are indispensable. We will never be sober one day at a time for the rest of our life on fellowship. Because we'll get drunk on the way. Because eventually you'll stop liking me or I'll stop liking you. Nor will we get sober just on recovery, because that will get boring and rote after a period of time. And this page, page 17, describes it probably better than any page in the big book. We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. Okay, I'm just reading. They have solved the drink problem. We are average Americans. All sections of this country, as well as many occupations, are represented, as well as many political, economic, and social backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix. But there exists amongst us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. We are like the passengers of a great liner when, moment after rescue from shipwreck, when joyousness, camaraderie, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Unlike the feeling of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our own individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which now binds us. But that in itself would have not held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact, and here's where it breaks on the fellowship into the plan of recovery, the tremendous fact for every one of us is we have discovered a common solution. If you're alcoholic like I'm alcoholic, we have a common disease. And if we have a common disease, thank God there's a common solution. We have a way out on which we can agree and join, absolutely agree, and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. My name is Robert, I'm alcoholic. Thank you, Robert.